Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the 363rd episode of Awards Chatter, the Hollywood Reporter's awards podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and my guest today is a popular young actress who has racked up a wide assortment of credits over her two decades in the business. From blockbusters like 2004's Mean Girls, 2008's Mamma Mia, and 2010's Dear John, to edgy indies like 2009's Chloe and 2013's Lovelace, to award-winning picks like 2012's Les Miserables and 2017's First Reformed, not to mention four seasons on the acclaimed HBO drama series Big Love. And she is now garnering the best reviews of her career and considerable Best Supporting Actress Oscar buzz for her portrayal of the actress Marion Davies opposite Gary Oldman's Herman Mankiewicz in David Fincher's Mank, Amanda Seyfried. Over the course of our conversation, the 35-year-old, speaking via Zoom from the farm in the Catskills where she lives with her husband, two kids, and many animals, talked about how she wound up in the business at such an early age and the sorts of pressures that she felt internally and that were imposed upon her to look a certain way as a young woman at the center of big studio movies, why she turned down the part in the 2014 Marvel film Guardians of the Galaxy that was ultimately played by Zoe Saldana, and instead confronted her stage fright head-on by making her theatrical debut off-Broadway in 2015's The Way We Get By, what the greatest challenges and rewards were of working for Fincher and playing Davies, who was sometimes dismissed as a pretty but lightweight actress, but actually had a lot to offer, not unlike the actress who plays her, plus much more. And so, without further ado, let's go to that conversation.
Amanda, thank you so much for joining us. Great to have you on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. So always begin on this podcast with just a few basics for the listeners. If you can share, where were you born and raised and what did your folks do for a living?
I was born and raised in Allentown, Pennsylvania. My father is a pharmacist and my mother was an occupational therapist in a psych rehab.
So before acting entered the picture, I think at a very young, even younger age, was modeling. So how does somebody from Allentown, Pennsylvania get into modeling in New York, I would assume?
You know, I read a lot of 17 magazine, YM. What was the youngest one? YM, and there was another, I forget what it was. I modeled for it once. And it was like really glamorous and it felt like it was out of left field. It felt like it was special. It was ridiculous. I mean, you got a picture like a 10-year-old just wanting to be a supermodel.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, wanting to be Cindy Crawford. And I didn't really know what that meant. I just knew that it seemed very glamorous and fun and people made you look nice and you got to wear pretty clothes. But it was very simple.
Was it a matter, though, of somebody kind of, you know, you hear these stories about somebody coming up to like a parent and their kid at the mall or something. Like, how did this even get started?
Actually, my second cousin worked at one of the local modeling agencies in Allentown. And I was like, I want to go there. I want to learn. And of course you buy these classes that are maybe $1,000 and they teach you how to walk on a catwalk and they take pictures of you. And I remember going to the mall, going to my favorite store at the time, which was a store called Limited 2 mm-hmm, for kids mm-hmm. and buying a silver biker jacket, a faux leather jacket. It was just bright, bright silver and buying it for a photo shoot. And then I ended up modeling for Limited 2, which was like, so it was really exciting for me because we had one in our mall, in our local mall. So I'd go to school and, you know, kids knew that I was, it's really dreamy, but that's probably one of the reasons it felt like it's something that I could easily do because it was local. Mm-hmm. And my cousin was into it.
So how then does that kind of give way to acting? Cause it seems like we're still in your like early teens even before teens when the modeling was starting, but when did acting start and how?
acting started when I was probably three. My daughter is 3 and a half, and she's absolutely going to be an actor among many things. But I can, I have an instinct, like, she's born with it. I mean, she has two parents that are actors. It's just something that I had. I always wanted to perform, and I think modeling was just one of the directions I could go in order to perform in some way. And what ended up happening was I did some local theater. I played a party kid in Christmas Carol, and I played like a rat in Wind in the Willows. And it's at a great theater. And then I auditioned for Fiddler on the Roof at the Pennsylvania Youth Theater, which is actually pretty prestigious, and totally didn't get any part. And I knew, okay, that's also something that I really, that I'm passionate about, but that seems so much harder than modeling because you actually need some other type of skill. My modeling agency that I ended up connecting with in New York City, because New York was only really an hour and 45 minutes from Allentown on a bus, I ended up being thrown into audition rooms, truly like scary audition rooms for Warner Brothers pilots. I remember meeting Rebecca Scholl, who played Faye on Wings, which is my favorite show. She was in one of the waiting rooms, and I was like, oh my God, I haven't made it. And I think it was like a vampire show. Of course, I didn't get the job, but I just found myself in those rooms and was pretty terrible for a while.
Well, so the first ones that actually seem to have come through would have been right in the late 90s, I guess, graduating from like day player things on some soaps, Guiding Light and whatever, to more regular appearances on soaps, As the World Turns and All My Children, all that. But, and I see, you know, in that same period, there's a Law and Order guest spot. There's a lot of stuff that, you know, for young actors in New York, I think I know people who were in a similar boat. It's like, you know, that's a nice solid start, but it wasn't, you know, you weren't on the fast track to being a star at that point. So, well, what was it like when you were still in regular school?
Yeah, I have graduated when I was 17, like as a senior from Allen High School. I didn't really work that much, luckily. I mean, I guess I would have rather have been working because I hated school, but I didn't work that much and it didn't get in my way. I was still doing honors classes with my friends and I was still playing tennis all 4 years. I was terrible at it, but I was still very committed to it. And it's kind of work kind of weaved its way in and out of my high school experience, except senior year. Of course, I that was half of the year. I think I made 80 days and my principal was like, of course you can graduate. I mean, if you do all your credits all the other years, it's like you don't have that much to do anyway. So he was really supportive of that because I was actually like really working then. Yeah. I was doing a lot of days on All My Children.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you've talked about in some other stuff I've read just prepping for this that, you know, school itself was not a good time. I guess you ironically, you dealt with some mean girls.
It was very divided in our school. There's one school in that area and four different middle schools would channel into this school. And the girls from the other school were different than my friends and I were in a lot of ways, ballsier. And I didn't feel like I ever fit in even with my own group of friends. And I'm telling you that as someone who's still very close friends with three of them. Mm. Like, we're all really still very tight. And I still didn't feel like I fit in. And I think that was just because there's just a hierarchy everywhere, I guess. And
I
didn't like it.
So
I don't want it. I don't want it for anybody.
So what happens? You graduate from high school and I read you were all set to go start at Fordham. Like what occurred that stopped that from happening?
That was, and it's the greatest story. And it's one of my clearest memories. I was rejected from NYU and I got into Fordham. They're the only two schools. And I got into Fordham and it was really exciting, but I was still on My Children. And I was like, oh, I'm just going to take classes. I'll take my basic classes. got fired or written off from all my children with my boyfriend at the time and somebody else. And everybody was like, what are we going to do? And I had auditioned for Mean Girls like within weeks of that firing. There's 3 weeks between the getting fired and knowing about Mean Girls and getting it Mean Girls. And during that time, the 3 weeks, I decided I had gotten it. Wait, what is it? I gotten in full time. I had to defer my getting into from full time to part time. I don't even know that lingo. I don't know nothing about college. And I paid for like $3,000 for the English composition class, the first class you take, 101, you know. And I flew out to LA right before a week before the class started. Flew out to LA, auditioned for Regina with my mom. My audition was Blake Lively, Lacey Chabert, and Lindsay.
Wow.
Weird. I was playing Regina. And I fly back. They're like, no, we want you to audition for Karen. I auditioned for Karen. And that screen test for Karen was the same day that I had my class at like 7 p.m. or something. And I go to Fordham and I'm late and I'm 15 minutes late. And there's nobody in the bays. Like I know, you know, there's like you go up an escalator. This is Lincoln Center campus. And there's like three or four elevators. I don't know how many, but they're huge. And there's nobody there. And I'm on phone with my parents. And my dad's like, just go home. It's fine. I'm like, I don't know. What if I don't get this movie? And I'm not going to show up to my class. Like, I can't. This can't be. How am I supposed to? And my mom's like, just go upstairs. And I'm like, but I'm 15 minutes late for my first class. It's really embarrassing. I got my money back. I left. I got my money back.
And so I guess the key question for people who are listening closely is, how did you go from auditioning for Regina, so which just ultimately was the Rachel McAdams played that part, to winding up as Karen, who we will remind people was maybe the ditziest of the group of the plastics, somebody who believes that her boobs can predict the weather and stuff like that. You know, how'd you wind up in that part? And was that must have been a huge deal, your first movie, right?
It was epic. I mean, I could never have dreamed of that. My expectations have been low my entire life for good reason. I just don't want to be disappointed. I hate being disappointed. So I never expected anything like this. And of course it just happened. But I think it was that I had auditioned for a lot of things at that point because I was 17. And so from 15 to 17, when I was getting more active in, you know, on my As the World Turns, and I was I turned 16 and I got all my children. And that year I had gotten a new manager and I was auditioning for a lot of stuff that I realized I was really into. Like I really wanted to be an actor. And that was senior year. And I would go in and out of auditions. And that was the summertime because we ended up shooting in September. So it was probably around July. I was reading the script and I was working with my manager and he's like, you should work with a comedic director. And I did. And he gave me these genius ideas. I was able to implement them. I was able to, like, the two of us together made a really great audition. And I went into the room and I kept going and I got another audition and the callback. And then that ended up, Mark Waters was like, oh, she's good. She's funny. And they were like, well, she doesn't really fit into this Regina role because I screen tested in LA. And he was like, we got to find a way to get her in it, which is the biggest compliment in the world. And it turns out that I was way more effective as Karen.
Very good. So that movie is obviously something that a whole generation of people connect to, and that puts you on the map to an extent. But then it wasn't like you were, you know, it was a while, but let's just say, so that's 2004. And then Mamma Mia, which I think is probably what really took things to a different level, is 4 years later. In the meantime, let's just talk about what was going on, because I assume that this is after Mean Girls is when you auditioned for another part that you didn't get, the one that you went out for, but on Veronica Mars.
Yeah.
Okay.
I wasn't ready for that though.
Not to play the title character yet.
Right. Okay. Lily Kane. That was a better role.
Yeah.
Better suited for me.
Yeah. And so that's happening around this time. That was 11 episodes over a period of between 2004 and 2006. Also a couple of smaller, movies that were respected, but not, you know, blockbuster. Nine Lives, one of the vignettes in there, Alpha Dog. But when along the line did you actually sort of go all in about moving to LA, which was going to be an important step?
Well, I was all in as soon as Mean Girls was over.
Okay.
I went back to New York. I was renting a ridiculously expensive apartment for what I could afford. I mean, it was this big. It was like the size of this little, what am I in a gable right now? I was like, this is ridiculous. I should go to LA and capitalize on this moment. And so my boyfriend at the time, from all my children, we drove across the country from Wisconsin with his dad and stayed with another friend of ours in an Airbnb, which they didn't have at that point. Right. It was a Craigslist thing. a little tiny one bedroom in Venice Beach, mm-hmm. which was awesome. Mm-hmm. But that was when I had just turned 18, just after December, just after finishing Mean Girls, I turned 18 and January we flew out. I mean, we drove out from Wisconsin. And then that week, because it was pilot season, I got Big Love and Veronica Mars. It was just...
Wow.
And I will say, I have to say, I do not think I got those roles based on Mean Girls or that I had just finished Mean Girls. Mm-hmm. No one had seen Mean Girls. We had just finished production. There was no chatter about it. I got them based on my skill level at the time and my auditions. And that felt really good because I knew that it wasn't, you know... Because sometimes you get movies based on other movies. Like, oh, they're in that. Ooh, they'll be good. You know,
this was separately.
The wrong reason.
Yeah, it's pretty cool to get two big TV projects within, you said, a week of getting out there. So the Veronica Mars was just sort of coming in and out of the show. But with Big Love, this is 4 seasons, 44 episodes over 6 years. And just to share with people, this is the character of Sarah, the rebellious daughter of a polygamist father, just a kind of crazy thing that was a big thing for HBO. And I guess I wonder, you know, for the first time to be playing a character, I think actually the only time over that long a period of time to be one character. Yeah, you were doing other things in, you know, during off seasons, but how did you like that and that whole period with that show?
I think I had a love-hate relationship with that show. I loved going to work and being with another family. I mean, it really did feel like, and I think you could ask any one of us, did it feel like a family? And everybody would agree that it did, because that's what happens when you do shows over that period of time. I was 18 when I started and I was 24 when I started, and I had a Mamma Mia in between. And it's amazing to be able to play a character who has an arc and goes through the motions of late teenagehood and early adulthood. And I think they created some awesome stories for me. And it was real, like, I really sharpened my teeth with that role for sure. And I got to feel confident in ways that I never had the time to. So that was great. And the downside is that it's an ensemble and I wasn't one of the wives and I didn't have as much to do. So I would have to go to work some days just to be in the background holding a kid. And I've always said that, and there's nothing wrong with that, but it could be frustrating at times. You know, I was really grateful that I was able to do a bunch of things at the same time, but I left for the last season. Cause I was like, there's just, and they were really kind about it. I mean, Bill was just a huge supporter. Are they all, I mean, Gene, a very important job for me. And I mean, well-written, everything, quality, just the whole thing was amazing. But I was at an age where I felt a little stuck by the end.
Sure. And obviously, as you say, right in the middle of this is when the first major game changer happened, which was, again, Mamma Mia. So just, you know, not that there are too many people who haven't seen the movie, but just setting it up. Sophie, this girl who's about to get married, wants to know who her real father is. This is your first leading role in a movie. Your mother is played by Meryl Streep. Just how did it even come about? Because again, it's not like, as you said, it didn't really, it's not like Mean Girls opened up a flood of opportunities or that you were a lead on these TV shows that you were doing. So how did that happen?
Well, I was singled out a little bit because it was a musical and I could sing. That was a major element, I think, to getting that role. And I also think they weren't really looking for anybody that had star power. They already had Meryl Streep.
Right.
They already had ABBA. They already had the business behind it with the show. God, when did that show come out? I didn't even know about it.
Mamma Mia, the show. Yeah, I think it was a few years earlier in the early 2000s, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I had never seen it. And I saw this beautiful brunette, curly haired girl with the wedding dress. And when I thought of Mamma Mia and auditioning for it, I'm like, well, I don't have brown hair. But, I thought I had to be Greek. And I'm like, I'm the farthest from Greek, but we'll see. And then I ended up seeing it in Vegas. And I was just, yeah, I'm total shoo-in. Yeah, for sure. But it also just looked so fun. So I just think that was based on... It had to have been based a little bit on work ethic or something that, or being able to trust me in some way, because Playtone also produced it.
Mm-hmm. This is Tom Hanks.
I know.
Production company.
It's Tom Hanks. Yeah. Tom Hanks, Gary Getzman, that was their baby. Big Love was their baby. And it had to have had something to do with it. They've never ever mentioned it to me, but I imagine it wasn't, you know, it was just a lot of elements go into stars a lot. I mean, stars have to align, you know?
Yeah. So, and was it intimidating to know that you're going to not only, you know, you hadn't professionally done much singing up to that point, and you'd done some training when you were younger, but it had been a few years. And so there's that element. Yes. There's the Meryl element, which intimidates people who have been doing, you know, the idea of working with her is exciting, but scares the shit out of people who had been doing it a lot longer than you had been. So just what was the mindset during the shoot?
Oh, well, when I finally got it, it was intimidating. Yeah. You hit the nail on the head. It's intimidating. I mean, you watch her work and you realize why she's so good. And it's not just because she's present and skilled. It's because she kind of knows everybody else's job. And that was the first time it clicked for me. Oh, I need to really be paying attention to these people's jobs. I mean, Big Love, I was just going on set and I knew everybody by name and we socialized and laughed, but I didn't really give a shit about what they did. I just knew that we were all collectively making this show. And so when I was on set, I kind of watch her watch people and understand where she fit in with the whole mechanism. And it's really important to understand what your part is in the mechanism. Because if you're not there, how can you expect somebody else to be there, right? It's just, that's work ethic too. And professionalism, of course. And I was still intimidated. I mean, it's still intimidating sitting on her lap, yeah, singing, you know, I am one of those people that I have a hard time being like very close physically to somebody when it's not my own mother or mainly if it's not my partner, mm-hmm, sitting on her lap. You know what I mean? It's just the things that were going through my mind when I'm supposed to be thinking about, you know, her getting my, you know, nails right when she's painting them and seeming sad and singing at the same time and listening to her at the same time and seeming like a daughter. I was like, am I too heavy for her? I wonder how uncomfortable she is. I hope my breath doesn't smell, you know, all that stuff that, you know, even for anybody, I'd be self-conscious about, but it was Meryl. So, mm-hmm, unfortunately for her, I imagine she gets, you know, that she has that orb around her that people probably can't really permeate. And that's sad because she's much more grounded than that. You know, she's a human being. And
yeah, when we had her on this podcast, we were talking about the fact that, like, one of the things that she feels now is sort of part of her job is when she shows up, she has to de-escalate the whole Meryl awe with coworkers, yes, because otherwise it's hovering over everything. So that was interesting.
It's definitely, I mean, I get a little bit of that, you know, just from being in the, you know, public figure, but her she's an entirely different playing field, and it just must be hard to break that every time she walks into a new room. And I just think it's just a bummer. But she does, I mean, she brings you down pretty quickly. When I first met her, actually, I was during a fitting with Anne Roth, and who actually lives very near Allentown. And she said, oh, we just love you in our house because of Mean Girls. Because she and her daughter, right. We just love you in our house. And I was like, oh, that's how she does it.
Right.
I feel good now. Yeah. I feel seen. And
right.
And I think it's a kind way to, like, a kind thing to do.
Yeah.
Because, you know, she knew I was intimidated.
Of course. Of course. I mean, it would be weird if you weren't. So this movie with, you know, all the buildup and the publicity and, you know, for the first time, you're probably seeing yourself in on giant billboards and all of that stuff. So when it comes out and does really well and everybody's seeing it and that continues, you know, it's not like that lets up. It's then it's on airplanes, then it's everywhere. How did your day-to-day life change because of that movie?
More people stopping me on the street, more press, more opportunities, more parties, you know, just more of the Hollywood thing. Because I lived in Hollywood and I definitely got more opportunities in movies. People knew who I was. And, you know, I got a big beauty campaign, a Japanese beauty campaign. I definitely started being more financially secure. I mean, I was always kind of on my own. Like I got my first apartment right when I got all my children. When I was late 16. And so I've always been on my own. I love living alone. And that just made me feel like I was really starting to get some kind of, I was starting to feel like a true adult.
Yeah.
Even though my mom still lives with me, but yeah, there was just a lot more responsibility.
Well, let's,
everything changed.
Let's talk about the roles that I believe were not already in the works before that. I would think these started to come out of it. So there's two in 2009 that were pretty notable. Jennifer's Body, written by Diablo Cody, coming off of Juno. You're the nerdy best friend turned assassin. There's that. That was an interesting, interesting movie there. But then the other one, which I don't know that a ton of people saw, but I remember this is 2009. I remember exactly being at the covering the Toronto Film Festival, being at the premiere, and there's a movie called Chloe for Adam McGuigan, where basically there's a call girl who ends up between Liam Neeson and Julianne Moore's characters who are married but suspicious of each other. And this call girl is played by you, who up to that point, I mean, I think maybe this was the purpose of taking the role, but like, wait, this is the girl from Mean Girls and Mamma Mia who suddenly, this is like a pretty sexy, edgy role that we have not seen her do before. So let's, you know, I guess really in a sense, the first adult that you're playing in a movie, how did we end up there?
So it's like what you said, diversity is really key when you're an actor and you're trying to get lost in your roles. It was that simple to me. And it's also about the challenge of getting out of your comfort zone in terms of the content and the emotional challenges as an actor, playing people that you don't relate to as well, and all of that. It was just a departure. That was my first major departure from, I think, the industry's perspective or people that did know me by that point. And for me personally, so that was why.
Yeah.
And Adam Agoyan is, God, it was the first time I ever felt like I was a real collaborator, that I was a peer.
Mm-hmm.
It's the first time I felt like I was on a level playing field with these incredibly talented people like Julianne and Adam.
Well, and we should say also, I think that, correct me if this is wrong, but so Jennifer's Body, I think, had been produced by Jason Reitman. And was he the one that sort of urged you to go do Chloe? Was there something there?
No, it was his dad who produced Chloe.
Oh, so, okay. So Jason produced Jennifer's Body, Ivan produced Chloe. And did Jason like suggest you to Ivan, or was there something with that?
I don't remember. I might've even shot Jennifer's Body after Chloe. I actually don't know. I don't recall any conversation about what happened between, was it Ivan who did, I think Ivan produced Chloe was something.
Yeah. Well, it's a Canadian. It's a Canadian movie with
God, I love those guys.
And they've definitely been had a lot of a good track record of giving young actresses a good platform.
So
I think one of the crazier things to do with Chloe, and not to harp on this, but I remember now, wasn't it like towards the end of the shooting that this terrible tragedy happened with Liam's wife? And then he comes back like right after
for a week
and finished the movie right after he lost his wife. It's crazy. But I guess sometimes it helps you. Yeah.
I think when you're, the only sense I can make of it, which I think is, I don't even know what that's like, but it's going back into a place where they weren't present every day, all the time. It's just doing something to distract. And he showed up and finished the job, and it was a week later. And yeah, God, that man.
Mm-hmm. Well, all right. So then after this is a period of a few movies I want to ask you about, because it seems like some of the things you've said in hindsight make it like, not that you regret having done these movies, but that you're maybe somewhat concerned that these might have changed people's perception of the sort of actress you were or wanted to be or whatever going forward. So these were some fairly big studio movies. There's Dear John in 2010, which is from one of these from Nicholas Sparks novel. He'd also, inspired The Notebook. You've got Letters to Juliet. You've got Red Riding Hood and In Time, all within a period of 2 years, coming out within a period of 2 years. Now, some of these were very successful. I mean, Dear John, after 2 months of Avatar being at number one at the box office, this is the movie that knocked that out of there. Red Riding Hood, I should ask you in a moment, because that was, I guess, your first time dealing with Gary Oldman, who was now almost 10 years later, obviously, with Mank. But just like, was that a time in your career where you or somebody around you was saying like, look, if you get these opportunities, you're in a big studio movie, you got to go down that path. Why not? It doesn't seem like that's where you're most at home. So I don't know. I just am curious.
That's the funny thing. Everything's deliberate for different reasons. And so the Red Riding Hood is basically, this is how it was brought to me. I remember I was at baggage claim at the airport. Leonardo DiCaprio is producing it. Catherine Hardwicke is directing it. Big, huge Warner Brothers movie. Lead role.
Yeah, why not?
Don't have to audition for it.
Yeah, why not?
Here you go. Leonardo DiCaprio?
Yeah.
You had me at Leonardo DiCaprio. That's why I did that movie. Letters to Juliet. Oh my God, that was such an experience. So Gary Winnick, I had met and fell in love with. She just was such a personality and clearly very passionate. That was my first big paycheck, like real paycheck. And which is funny because you think about all those movies that I'd done before.
Yeah, right.
You can imagine being a young woman in Hollywood.
Yeah, right.
There were no paychecks, which is still, well, yeah. And so that's another great thing. And it was being produced by a lot of cool people. And I got to go to Italy. Mm-hmm. Which is like, duh.
Yeah, these are all good reasons. Yeah.
Vanessa Redgrave.
Right.
Yeah. And that was scary because that was the first time it was me. Mm-hmm. That was me. Like, I was the first number one on the call sheet. And that was terrifying. So when that movie was about to come out, I was like, oh my God, box office really does mean so much. But before that was Dear John. And I wanted to be part of Dear John because The Notebook was such a huge thing for Ryan Gosling and Rachel McAdams. Mm-hmm. And it was a sweeping romance. And I love sweeping mm-hmm. romances. Mm-hmm. So that was just...
And there's worse things than having to be in a love story with Channing Tatum, I would think.
Yeah. Oh, my God. And it couldn't have been more perfect. Mm-hmm. He was so awesome. Lasse Hallström, like, there's just a perfect... I had auditioned a bunch of times. Mm-hmm. So that was a big get for me.
Right.
And it turned out it did great, like you said, and knocked off Avatar. And that was my first experience. I remember being more a part of such a big box office win.
Mm-hmm.
Because with Mamma Mia, I didn't really understand the box office so well.
Mm-hmm.
But with Dear John, I knew what we wanted.
Right.
And we surpassed what we wanted. Which is why streaming is so wonderful.
Yeah.
Because that headache.
Yeah, you don't have to think about
that
it.
It weighs so much on you. You're like, I had a great experience. I loved working with these people. I would do it again in a heartbeat. I think it turned out pretty good. And, but really the, you know, how you're going to rank it, how you're going to measure the quality of it is in how many people go see it. That's bullshit. But that's how it is.
Yeah. So I want to note, like, all right, you're doing with Dear John. Again, you're up against, you're opposite Channing Tatum. You're at that time, I think you said you had a beauty campaign in Japan. You're on most beautiful lists and all of that kind of thing. And yet, despite all of this, here's a quote from around that time that I came upon here from you. Quote, "I worried on the set of Dear John that they wouldn't think I looked like they wanted me to look. That's always my fear. I hope they weren't mad at me." Close quote. What's that about?
That's so sad. Well, I was given a trainer. And the trainer put me on a specific diet. I haven't thought about this in a while. And that's not okay. But listen, I think they, I told myself, I don't know what it was. I don't know what they were thinking, but it made me feel really good. And it was really fun and it was free. And the food was actually fantastic. And it came to my house. Mm-hmm. Okay. And Harley, the trainer, was awesome. I had so much fun. But that put extra pressure, like, oh my God, I'm going to be in a bikini. And I don't do bikinis. I do one pieces. I don't do bikinis. I don't like my stomach. I've never liked my stomach. Well, now I just don't give a shit. But like, I'm 35.
Right.
But I didn't want anybody to see my stomach. I was always a little, I have a short torso. I have a thing about my belly. I did. And it was never going to be skinny enough for me. And I was never going to try it hard enough because I'm And I was afraid that I was not fit enough for that movie because I never did the diet fully.
But now, were you having these concerns about any of this prior to them saying, hey, you know, was it like, hey, you need a trainer or hey, you should have a trainer? Or was this the only reason I'm bringing this up at all is just that I think that it's maybe illustrative of what some of the pressures are for a young actress in Hollywood. And the fact that you, at a time when the vast majority of people are out in the world already thought you looked great and had no issues, I just was wondering, is this coming from yourself or from other people?
Myself. And it was made more challenging by other people saying, we need you to have this trainer. We need you to do his diet. And I was like, okay. You know, first questioning it, but then thinking free workouts. And it was hard to keep, you know, to only eat what I was sent. You know, of course I will never be able to do that. And that's okay. Cause I think I'm always going to struggle with that slightly. I'm glad I have a really good handle on it. I need to be healthy for myself and for my kids. But that was not just then, that was all the time. I came into high school feeling like I needed to do more ab workouts. And the thing is, I was too lazy to actually do it. So I just gave myself a hard time for not doing it. And I will tell you, I was 10 pounds heavier until I was in my mid-20s because of all the free food on set.
Yeah.
Big Love. You see me in Big Love. That was healthy.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't see that as healthy. I was like, I gotta look like everybody else. And I knew a lot of girls at that time, at that age, that were calling me up, not to tell me this, but also saying, you know, they want me to go on a diet or they, you know, mm-hmm. They think I need to lose 10 pounds. And that was the thing.
Yeah. I hope it's not anymore, but who knows?
It can't be anymore.
Yeah.
I think there are now finally rules against it, but I'm sure there always is body shaming. And I think people want the lead romantic love interest to, I don't know what they want, to have a six pack and some biceps. I mean, I can't.
Well, luckily, you know, so after that period of, you know, just having, you know, again, and I get also, if you're going to be on a billboard and all that, I think it would screw with anybody's mind. But so those are a few years, a couple years in a row of big studio stuff. Then there's the movie for Tom Hooper coming off of The King's Speech, winning all the Oscars, a bunch of Oscars, Les Mis, where, of course, you're getting to sing again. This is playing cassette. But, you know, you'd sung in Mamma Mia. You'd sung before that. Here you are going to be doing it in super close up live alongside people like Hugh Jackman. So is this now more pressure, or is that exciting, or how did you think about that going into it?
Oh, I was like, that was really stressful. I just have to preface this by saying that I auditioned 6 times for it.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
And I was told no right off the bat by the casting director. No, I wasn't told that. My agent was told that. And I said, that's you. Trust me. I am Cosette. I can do this. And luckily I got it. And getting on that set was, oh my God. No matter how much rehearsal we had, I was never ready. And I look back, I can't even watch it because I sound so shrilly and weak. And that was coming off of only having, at that point, 6 months. I went back into actually fully training with a voice coach in August of 2011. And we started shooting, I think, the beginning of 2012. And it wasn't enough time. I had a voice coach on set. Every time we'd have to do it live, I would just freak out. And I wish I could go back and redo all the singing.
I'm surprised to hear you say that, because people, again, I think this might be more in your own head, because people enjoyed it and I didn't hear any specific dumping on you about your voice. So you're saying you were not happy with how you came?
Thank God. I thought the movie was so beautiful and everybody was so wonderful in it. And I liked my performance, but as soon as I opened my mouth to sing, my vocal cords were just cowering inside. They're like, oh, is it me? Oh, and then I would just tense up. And I realized now it's been over 9 years. I can confidently say that I am ready to play Cosette in Les Mis if I were to have the opportunity again.
Well, that's, that would be cool to see a reunion.
It would be.
Okay, so I remember hearing about and then going to see this movie. I was very skeptical about Linda Lovelace, who was best known as the star of Deep Throat and had a very complicated life. And Oscar-winning directors of documentaries, Rob Epstein and Jeffrey Friedman, were behind it. I didn't see it at Sundance where it premiered, but then it starts rolling out. And I, again, really skeptically went in to see it. And I thought it was one of the best things you've done. And I think a lot of other people did as well.
Thanks. Yeah. That was the first time I'd ever stepped in the shoes of somebody real, and another very deliberate choice. I think there were two different scripts flying around about Linda Lovelace, and this is the one that got made first. And I did as much work as I could on figuring out who this woman was. And then I also knew that I was, you know, trying to show a side of her that people didn't really know. And that gave me a little bit of freedom, and we were in touch with her family. And so I felt very supported, but it was hard. God, it's so hard, because you just need to find an essence there that works for the story. And if you don't, just what's the point?
Okay, so when Lovelace came out, there's an article that was written that I read prepping for this, where you said, quote, "This film is really, I feel, the beginning of something else for me," close quote. What were you, you know, what were you hoping would be the next phase that it was going to open up?
I think I just wanted some more roles like that. I think I just wanted to explore other parts of myself, and, you know, everything's a little cathartic, especially a role like that. And I thought maybe this would, within the industry, I don't know, help people trust that I could do other things.
Yeah.
Because you can't control who sees these things or who doesn't, like who knows what of your career. You know, I didn't ever expect anybody to know any great directors that I'm enamored by to know who I was. So these roles are always, I do it for the experience. I deliberately choose to do things that I won't, what I don't think I would ever regret, and things that will challenge me, and things that are different from other things that I've done. And then you hope that when it comes out, if it's good, and if my performance is good, then people trust me to do, to have, you know, to give me other opportunities. That's always the hope.
Yeah. Well,
never the expectation.
And it's tough because it's the number of people that show up is not always at all related to the quality of the movie. As I mean, another example, I think one of the funniest movies I remember, and I actually think it's better than Marriage Story and some of his movies that get more attention, but Noah Baumbach with While We're Young, I laughed my ass off at that. I mean, I still think about the scene where, so just to set it up for listeners, I mean, this is the year after Lovelace. It's you and Adam Driver as a couple from one generation, and then Ben Stiller and Naomi Watts, and both are sort of, in a sense, competing with the other. And there's the hip hop class where Naomi goes to try. She thinks she's going to like some workout class, I think. And then you guys, you know, she finds herself in the middle of a hip hop class. There's some funny, very funny stuff there. And yet, I don't know that it got widely seen, unfortunately.
It didn't. It went to Toronto the same year as, God, something else, I think, that I did. Or maybe that was just that one, maybe. Oh, yeah, it was just that movie that year. But, yeah, it was funny. It's funny how things hit and don't hit. But the experience of making it is always, you know, you always have something to go back to.
Yeah.
It was hilarious. I mean, that was a... He's amazing, Noah. Like, he knows what he's doing. He's very smart and dry and makes a great points.
Yeah.
And I love watching his movies.
So I think it would have been right around that time that you sort of acted on maybe something you've been feeling for a while but hadn't done, which was essentially like getting the hell out of the center of things, whether that's LA or New York. What was the, and also passing on some things that on paper, you know, you're probably supposed to do, right? The one that has come up is Guardians of the Galaxy, for instance. Somebody comes and offers you a Marvel movie. Theoretically, you're supposed to do that. It's a big payday. It can only be good. But what happened that made you say, you know what, I've got to kind of hit the brakes a little bit and just resituate myself a little bit?
It was never to hit the brakes. I never wanted to slow down or hit the brakes. Even when I had kids, I accidentally had, you know, I wasn't, that was never a plan. It was always a plan to have kids, of course. I didn't plan it then in both instances. So it was never a deliberate, like, I need to slow down or stop. It was just that I was afraid. There was two things. I was afraid of, I remember I was sitting on my agent's couch because my agent is also a very good friend of mine. I've been with her since I was 16. I was sitting on her couch and on the phone with the other agent because the offer had just come in and I had just met with James Gunn. And I didn't want to be a part of the first Marvel movie that bombed.
That's something, yeah.
Because I said, who wants to see a movie about a talking tree and a raccoon? Which is clearly, I was very wrong. And that was all based, not that the script was great. It was all based in not wanting to be that guy. Because if you are the star of a giant movie like that and it bombs, you're, Hollywood does not forgive you. I've seen that people make, I've seen that happen to people and it was a giant, giant fear. And I thought, is it worth it? And then the other thing is I knew that it was, I knew the people who were blue had a lot of, they were sitting in makeup more than they were actually on set. And there was all green screens. And I thought, I don't want to be green for 6 months. I don't want to have to go to work and get green and then have a few hours to do my job and then get ungreen to just go back to work and get green again. I've done prosthetics before. It's not fun. Yeah. And so I made a good choice for myself in my, for my life.
But was this part of a larger thing though? Because isn't this around the same time that you moved to the Boondocks?
Oh yeah. Right? I think, was that 2013? I did buy a place in 2013, but I always knew I was going to be wandering the earth working. I always knew that I just needed a home base, and I needed a place where I knew that I could thrive when I wasn't working and feel safe and be close to the city. So that was that choice. I always wanted to be upstate.
Yeah.
It always seems so glamorous.
Well, the other thing that in normal times is very associated with New York is theater, which is something you had not done at all, I believe, until 2015, when I went and saw at Second Stage, I think it was only 70 minutes, a show called The Way We Get By, Neil LaBute. And let's just remind folks, this starred, or let them know, because it's not a huge house. I mean, it's a small theater, and it was box theater, but really great. It was Thomas Sadowski, who actually is from, I've talked to him about this. I'm from Woodbridge, Connecticut. A little tiny dinky place, which is adjacent to Bethany, Connecticut, where I believe he's from, and theater actor. And then yourself. Did you guys know each other even before that? Or was that where this, I think we're now 5 years, one marriage and two children later, right?
I know. I did not know who he was. I had not seen him on the stage. You know, doing a play was always something I wanted to do, because I understood it to be the biggest challenge for an actor, and the biggest, it gave you the most in return, and then you get to just walk away from it. And I always wanted to be on stage and experience that. And I don't know if I could ever do it again. God, that was terrifying. But I did have nights of just pure bliss where I just felt like I was flying. And that was, I'm so glad that was my first play, because I was going to do a different play. I almost played Sylvia. Is it Sylvia? The dog?
Yeah.
I almost played Sylvia. And then that was a weird thing, because there was Julie White and myself and Bradley Whitford. We did the reading and we were going to do the play, and then happened to Bradley and me. But that's just weird politics and business, I guess. But that was going to be my first like show, and it was going to be on Broadway. And I was so excited about it, because I was like, I love dogs. I'm playing a dog. This is the funniest play ever. And then when that didn't work out, I was like, oh God, I'm heartbroken. I'm so heartbroken that this just all of a sudden it fell into my lap, and then it was taken away from me. And I was like, I gotta get on stage. And then there was another show that was a possibility, and then this came along, and it was a two-person play, and I don't know why I did that. It was like jumping to the deep end first, and I think thankfully I did. Would we have met each other? I'm sure. This was definitely amazing, because we connected in such an amazing way, and I felt so safe with him on stage, even when I was having panic attacks.
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to ask, is like, you know, you're talking about being excited to do theater, but at the same time, like a lot of people don't realize, a lot of actors have this, but why were you wanting to do that to yourself when you know that you have to some degree panic attacks or stage fright or whatever you want to call it?
I thought that I would be all right. I really did believe when we were in rehearsal, I was finding so much. I was feeling so alive and so challenged and really very, very present. And just my almost, I don't know how to say it, my spirit was calm. I know that sounds could sound kind of weird, but I felt like that's where I needed to be, and that was the play I needed to be doing with the people I was doing it with. And when we had our first dress rehearsal, and you know, the nights after that, I don't know what they're all called, but I felt like this is like flying. This is the first I've ever felt this. I don't even know the word. It was magical. I was creating this whole world for people, and I felt the energy of the audience. And there's something there that you can't recreate anywhere else. And everybody who's been on stage knows the feeling, and it is addictive. And this is, you get the bug, and it is so not like film at all, because you're in it and you can't get out of it. And so you spin it around until it's done. And then all of a sudden you've given yourself and these people this, you've taken them on this whole journey. It's so amazing. I'll never do it again. But halfway through, I had a moment of feeling really dizzy and panicky, and it killed the rest of the run. It just killed it for me.
And there's nothing you can really do about it, right?
No, I never faltered. I stayed on stage and we got through it every night. But from that moment, my body was telling me, no, it's going to happen again. My head was telling me it's going to happen again. My body's like, just trust. And some nights it didn't happen, but it was always on my mind, and it totally ruined the experience for me.
What does it feel like? It's like just having a weight on your chest, or what is it?
It's fight or flight. For me, fight or flight is I get really dizzy. The lights get really bright. I'm short of breath, and I feel like I have to just run. Like my whole body goes cold. It feels like I'm about to faint, but much worse, because I'm not actually going to faint. And my body still didn't at that point understand what I needed to do. And so I would just plant my feet and keep saying the lines, and he'd see it every night. We'd leave the stage and we go up the stairs of the dressing rooms. He's like, are you all right?
So in a way, I guess you probably were able to bond over that. I mean,
oh my God, I felt so safe with him. I mean, theater is much more intimate than anything else for an actor. And I felt like I'd known him my whole life, and I felt like he understood who I was. He saw me. He saw everything that I was going through. He figuratively held my hand through it. And it created the foundation for an incredible relationship, whether it was a friendship at that point, there was no way that was ever going to happen at that point for either of us. But there was that spark, like, what if in a parallel life? But then we got to do it in this life, which is really special. And we got to do a movie together.
That's great. Well, these last few years have been pretty interesting, because I know on a personal level, you've been busy, you know, with your starting a family and all of that. Then in the meantime, you know, it's sort of like, it feels like what do they call it? Like military airstrikes, where you pop in, it's not a necessarily a huge part or something, but it's gone over great. So like First Reformed, Paul Schrader, one of the best reviewed movies of 2017. I don't know that you have a ton of screen time in there, but people were very impressed. There's the scene, just to remind people, you're a pregnant parishioner with a suicidal husband, and Ethan Hawke's the priest that's kind of gets involved with this. Then there's a few episodes of Twin Peaks, which has a cult following of its own. Another Mamma Mia in 2018. And all of this leading up to Mank, where, you know, we'll get into this more in the intro, but just to remind folks, this is you playing Marion Davies, the actress, comedian who lived with William Randolph Hearst at his castle, San Simeon. Here it's David Fincher. And the thing I really like, I'm obsessed with film history. So to me, I was waiting to catch cheats where, you know, it's not accurate or whatever. But I think it's one of the most faithful to history movies about the movies I've ever seen. And it's right down to, you know, she was really the first person with a giant movie star trailer that would follow her as she went from studio to studio. Stuff that you guys really capture in the movie, where I don't know if it would make a difference to most people if it wasn't even in there, but it means something to people that really love film history, because they get that this is taking it seriously. So how did this happen in the first place, where you find out that David Fincher knew who you were, wanted to consider you for this? What was the beginning of it all?
I was at Penn Station getting the train back up here. I remembered what I was doing. What was I doing? I was working on a movie that I produced, tiny, tiny movie that we, you know, I put blood, sweat, and tears into. And I think we were in rehearsals, and I was going back up to home. I was going home, and my agent, Abby, calls me and says, there's Fincher's doing a movie called Mank about Herman Mankiewicz. And I was like, okay, that's great. And, you know, they're asking your availability. There's a chance that, you know, he would want you to be in it. And I was like, oh, okay. He knows me. Like, are you sure it's him and not just the casting director? And she's like, no, I'm speaking to the casting director. And yes, he's mentioned you. And I cried. It was a very teary train ride back.
Why do you think you reacted that way?
Because it seemed like the possibility came out of nowhere, and I couldn't have felt more passion for something I didn't know anything about because it was him. And because, you know, again, no expectations, but you hear that and you can't help but go into that world and think, what would that mean for me? That would mean that somebody I truly have looked up to as a master for so long would allow me to enter his world. And I, for it as an actor, as a human being, I was just as an adult living in the world, to feel like I'm trusted enough to be even considered for something like this was a big deal. And it was very exciting.
So at that point in time, how familiar were you with the name Herman Mankiewicz, the name Marion Davies, even Citizen Kane? If you're not somebody who grew up like obsessed with movies, maybe it's just a name. What was your familiarity with all this at that point?
I'd heard of Marion. I could picture her when she mentioned the character. I have seen Citizen Kane when I was early 20s, mm-hmm. getting into films, educating myself.
Yeah.
That was it. I didn't know who Herman Mankiewicz was. I knew that Mankiewicz was a name that I knew because Josh Mankiewicz is one of the Dateline anchors.
Yes, exactly.
We watch all of the Datelines in this household. There's not a one we have not seen.
Right.
And so I started, you know, getting on my tiny computer and doing some research. And I didn't do much. I just got the call. And
so that the part's yours, or you have to come in and meet David, or what was the process?
We had a Zoom call. It was the first time I used Zoom because I didn't know, mm-hmm. I didn't know about Zoom. So I had to download it first on my computer. And then I called in on a night that I'd worked many, many hours, mm-hmm. and I'd read the script that day between shots and most of during my lunch break. I'm a slow reader. It was a lot to do in one day. And I'm playing a suicidal mother in postpartum. It was heavy stuff.
Yeah.
So I talked to him from like 10 at night to like 11:15 by the time we got off the phone, and he just talked to me about it. And we had a finally after 45 minutes or whatever of him explaining how he was going to shoot it and what it was going to be and what it meant to him and all that, we finally started talking about the script and how I felt. He was asking me questions about how I felt about certain scenes. And I got to tell him how I felt because I felt something, like I had things that I wanted to say. And he gave me the opportunity, and we had a back and forth about it. And I felt like he heard me, and we talked about Marion and what he wanted from Marion. And I guess by the end of that conversation, I was in, because then we were talking about schedule. And the schedule was like, I didn't know if I was going to be able to actually pull it off because I had to get another movie that I was doing after that to... But the point was, I wasn't supposed to be working at all. I was actually going to try to take time off because my sister was having a baby. And I was going to go out to LA, and I was going to be her doula. And I was going to help them over Christmas in LA. And I was going to be there with my daughter, my mom, everybody. And I, after my passion project that I was like pouring everything into, I was like, I'm going to be done. And I ended up getting into this other movie, Things Heard and Seen, because it was just too good to pass up, because they were shooting up here, mm-hmm. in Pine Plains, mm-hmm. and Kingston. So it was my neck of the woods, and it was so fun. And then Mank happened. I was like, God, I can't believe this. I don't know how I'm going to do this. And I honestly still don't know how I did it, because I was getting on midnight flights and landing at 6 a.m. and going for 8 a.m. rehearsals and flying back and then coming back in at 5 a.m. on Mondays. It was horrible, but the best thing ever, because I got to be in Mank, I guess.
Yeah. Well, question about Marion Davies, and this is something that, you know, I want to be careful how I say this, because I want to, I don't want it to come to be misinterpreted in any way, but I wonder if you felt any kinship with Marion, who was always described, you know, this is this pretty young actress who's good to have in the business and all of that, but was basically underestimated for a lot of her career. Even after, it didn't help that they, in Citizen Kane, basically had the person playing her be a drunk loony. But even apart from that, I don't think she ever really got the opportunity or the respect that she wanted and probably deserved. So I wonder if for you, as if there was any relationship to that. And then the fact that that is coming as a result of playing her, you know, the more respect and accolades and all that. Just am I imagining something here, or is there anything to that?
It is kind of amazing that, well, first, it's kind of amazing that Marion was definitely underestimated and but just not as respected, I think, as she would have been today. I mean, she did a lot of movies. From the movies that I saw, she was effervescent. She was the girl you wanted to know more about, and she was hilarious. And she's kind of reminded me in some ways of Karen, in that she, you know, I don't, the way she negotiated her way through scenes, it just seemed like you have to be smart in order to play somebody like that. And you could see her wheels turning, and you always felt like she was really there. I think she was a fantastic actress, actually. And I think a lot of people do too. And I think they do put, you know, after she's gone, of course. I don't know. I think it was her relationship with Hurst and how he kind of wanted a handle on her career and wanted her to do certain things that she didn't want to do. And she ended up kind of just petering out in a way. And I think that's, that doesn't happen anymore. I mean, not as much, but also, and I don't know how many regrets she had, because I do believe she was very loyal and did really love this man. But I think she had so much more to give, and so much, she just could have worked up until, you know, the end, probably, hopefully. And yeah, I mean, do I feel like we don't have too many parallels? I think the thing that I related to most about Marion, and in these scenes in Mank, was I saw the similar rapport that Gary and I have in these scenes. And I thought, this is aces. I get her. I really get her. She's really funny. She can hang out with anybody. She can make anybody feel comfortable. And she's brutally honest. Like, I cannot tell a lie. I am how I am. And I can try not to curse as much as I do, which I'm trying to do, but she's very similar in that way. And she doesn't, I mean, how much credit does she deserve? I don't know, more than she got. I don't think I am deserving of more credit than I'm getting. I think it's happening I'm getting quote unquote credit. I'm getting, like, you know, discussion surrounding my performance, which is an amazing thing. It's thrilling. I've never expected it. I've never been sad that it wasn't happening. And I've always been grateful that I've been mentioned. Like Paul Schrader, like you said, that Paul Schrader movie. Like, I was getting some honorable mentions in that, like someone else said. And I think that's beautiful. I love the fact that I got to experience that.
Well, David Fincher did an interview recently where he was talking about the fact that, you know, obviously this movie is not just about that time period, but he wanted it to feel like it was made in the same time period as Citizen Kane, which meant not just black and white cinematography, but the acting style. This is pre-Brando, pre-method acting, pre, you know, wearing your emotions on your sleeve and, you know, sort of what we know with all of that. So it's different. It's very stylized, and it feels exactly right for what he was trying to do. But I wonder, that's got to be an adjustment for you to just essentially, like, the way David's talking about it is just, he said, quote, just go spit it out. Like, as far, close quote, as far as the, what he wanted you guys to do with the lines. It's not, you know, pauses and, you know, stuff that is more modern style of acting. But again, that's what
my style. It's my style of acting. I think about things. My cadence is always really hard to reenact in ADR. Always. Yeah. I'm like, I actually thought I was way too modern to play Marion. That was, sorry to cut you off, but that was literally, that was like my biggest fear, is that, wow, I wasn't going to fit into this world.
And so how do you make that work? What was the, is it just literally slowing down or not, or just saying the line? Like, what is the, what was it that you guys were doing there?
Oh God, we knew our lines way too well. So that's really important to know your lines that well. That's going to take you very far, I think, especially if he wants you to spit it out. I wasn't conscious of trying to imitate the, you know, because to me, when I first started digesting that I was going to be in this movie, I really didn't think I was capable of fitting in to this era. And it's because I what I pictured was people talking like this, and, you know, it's like, you know, the way Jimmy Stewart talks. There is an affectation that I see it as an affectation that I was like, I don't know how, that's not gonna be natural for me. I've been skating through my career trying to be as natural as possible, just as realistic as possible, even if it doesn't completely match the character. It just, try to find the honesty in everything, right? So when you're playing different people, other people in different eras, that's a giant mountain for me, and I definitely wanted to climb it. I just didn't know how I was going to do it. And by the time we were on set, I'm telling you, I had the accent, the mild Brooklyn accent, which is something that comes naturally to me because I've done it before. Mm-hmm. And I do it mildly because if I flub a little bit, you don't notice. That's the point. Always do an accent mildly is right, the way it works for me. And I have a good ear for them. So far, so good for me. But
right,
with lightning, I was not conscious by the time we were on set at all of how I was going to sound. Because if I was, it would have just ruined
the
experience.
Well, so here's the other part of that question, I guess, is it's not news to anyone that David does a lot of takes. I mean, this is something there, and it's worked for great directors forever. I mean, back in the era that you guys are portraying, that was William Wyler. And then every generation since, there's somebody that does it. And I wonder if what your understanding is of why David likes to do so many takes. I don't know if there was a specific scene that you were referencing when you were talking about, there was one that might've taken a week and 200 takes to get. I would love to know which one that is, but just, what's your understanding? Like, I would be saying, if I'm not an actor, but I would think I would, like, what are you looking for after them? What is something going to be different? How many ways can you do something? So was it something that you, how did you respond to it? And what did you make of it?
I always got to a point where, because I'd never done, I mean, it's like theater. I'd gotten to a point at times where I was just like, I really don't know what else I can do. I hate myself now. But that doesn't stop you or him. What he's doing, it is math. To put it more simply, you got a lot of people in the scene. You got a lot of people saying different things in the scene. It's you got a big set piece. People are in different positions. That means you have that many more camera angles and that many more setups. And if each setup is, you know, 20, 30, 40, whatever it takes, you just got to factor that in, and you're in 4 days into it. And it's kind of luxurious to have that much space and time to work on something. And I realize that it really works for me. I do get tired. Of course I get tired. Everybody would get tired. But to know my lines that well and to really feel like I'm sitting comfortably into this role, it doesn't happen. It just doesn't happen, because sometimes you just want to go home. And sometimes you only have an hour for a scene, and sometimes you're losing the daylight. And so, you know, all these elements to movie making that don't really work for the actor so much as just the movie as a whole, and all the pieces, the moving pieces. And it sucks because budgets are lower and, you know, we run out of time. And here we just didn't ever run out of time. It didn't feel like we did.
the scenes where you guys were doing the most takes, are you saying those are the ones where it's like Mayor and everybody sitting there in San Simeon? Is that, or were there other ones where it was just, you know, the most, which was the most takes?
Oh God, I don't know. I don't think I was there for that. I feel like, oh no, maybe. Okay. Here's what I'm certain this was the most takes because we had to reshoot it. So you're maybe okay. 8 days altogether. We shot the one where the scene where I meet Mank and we meet Hearst. The audience meets Marion and Hearst.
Yeah.
And LB and, Irving Thalberg are sitting. Yeah. That's, we reshot that. And by the way, the reshoot is just so much more glorious in how I felt as Marion, as Amanda, even though I was pregnant at that point.
Oh my gosh. Well, and I guess you had some weird things with this movie because the looping and stuff was post pandemic, right? So that would also be probably an unusual way to have to do a movie.
It's more like that was the most similar to the experience pre-COVID than anything else. The doing ADR at home is nothing. It's the way it should be done from now on because the technology is definitely there for it.
Yeah. All right. So last question is, you know, this movie hits Netflix on Friday, I believe. It's already in some theaters. Unfortunately, we don't have any theaters where we are. I don't know about you, but just as you've started getting the feedback, we talked a little bit about how positive it's been for the movie, for the performance, that aspect of things. And then what you've made of that and what you now hope to do, if you think about this as sort of like currency in the sense that there's now people that are, more people want to get aboard the Amanda Seyfried train right now. What do you want to do with that? What's the next move?
I think this is my next move is going to be the most deliberate move I ever made. And I am really hoping that I'm considered first or second for things that I never was considered for before. In that, there are directors that I've been dying to work with for years and never got the opportunity because they have their favorite collection of actresses, which I get, of course. There's the loyalty and there's trust, and that's how I would be. But now I'm that much closer to being in the handful, and I feel like, okay, I'm in David's handful now. Who's else who trusts me now, or who wants to see me play this role? I never want to stop working. And I think I could afford to do less in terms of just having a full family at this point. I don't want to work all the time, but when I work, I want it to be fucking good. And I want it to be like an experience I had on Mank. That's what I want to do. I want to work with a director who knows exactly what they want. And I never have to worry about anything but my performance. It's gold. And I totally just, I feel like a kid now. I feel like it's the best I've ever felt. It's the most solid I've ever felt. It's the most thrilling experience, the most thrilled I've ever been, you know, I got this opportunity. I showed up. The movie's amazing. I feel good about my performance. People like it too. It just doesn't always add up to that. And this one does, and I'm capitalizing on it. I'm going to do everything I need to do to get this movie seen by as many people as possible. And I'm going to sit back and just enjoy it because you never know what's going to happen. But I do feel like I have a better chance of getting those opportunities now. I want those opportunities. Well, and I want to see again.
Yeah, well, that's good to know. People, it's good. You put this out there. You never know who's listening. And
Donna Langley, are you listening? Yeah. How about Mark Platt? Are you listening? I'm Glinda and Wicked, all right?
Right. So let me let you go do your thing. But thank you so much for this and enjoy the ride.
Bye, guys. Thank you. Bye.
Thanks very much for tuning in to Awards Chatter. We really appreciate you taking the time to do that, and would really appreciate you taking a minute more to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or your podcast app, and to leave us a rating as well. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can reach me via Twitter at twitter.com/ScottFeinberg. And you can follow all of my coverage between episodes at thr.com/therace. Until next time, thanks for joining us.